Инаугурация президента Соединенных Штатов Америки.
Символика с изображением 45-го президента США, во всяком
карта
случае.
Карта Трампа, вытащенная из стертой политической колонны.
Новый президент США готовится снова сделать Америку великой.
Дональд Трамп наш человек.
The Ukrainians and Georgians fear it, the Baltics are worried about it, the Europeans are concerned about it, and in the Kremlin they seem to be rubbing their hands in glee. The inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States today appears to many to mark the start of a new era of détente between Russia and the United States and the end of the liberal post-Cold War international order. Many also believe it heralds the realization of Vladimir Putin's dream of a Yalta-like division of the world into spheres of influence. But does it? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, and happy Inauguration Day.
Happy Inauguration Day. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, a former Russian Foreign Ministry official, a columnist for Republik.ru, and president of the Left Group. Welcome back, Vladimir.
Thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for coming on. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior policy fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Welcome back, Don.
Happy Inauguration Day.
Happy Inauguration Day, and you're right in the eye of the storm, I see. So in recent days, Donald Trump's called NATO obsolete. He's derided the European Union as a vehicle for German ambitions, and he's sharply criticized German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Russian opposition figure and former world chess champion Gary Kasparov had a snarky tweet this week saying he's wondering when Trump will say something about foreign affairs that the Kremlin hasn't said first. Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, meanwhile, have said they are looking forward to working with Trump, and Putin even suggested in a press conference this week that Trump's opponents are plotting a Maidan-style uprising to overthrow him. In a piece for the European Council on Foreign Relations this week, Mark, you argued that when these two finally do meet, when this finally happens, the bromance might not turn out to be what it's all it's cracked up to be. Why do you think that?
I think three reasons, really. One is just in terms of the personalities in question. At the moment, after all, they don't know who each other is. They've never met. They don't actually have any kind of relationship. In many ways, they are ciphers to the other. When they actually meet, you have two sort of soi-disant alpha males, both of whom have a reputation for essentially trying to dominate meetings, whether it's by sort of holding forth or whether it's by gambits like always being very late. And they're very, very different personalities. Putin, whatever else we might say about him, he is known for his meticulous preparation for summits and his appreciation for professionalism. Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, is not. And quite how Trump will come across to a Russian president who may well find it sort of useful to be handling what might seem like an amateur, but has also historically regarded one of his key problems of the West is he feels the West is hypocritical, that it lies, it goes back on promises. And as we've already seen with Donald Trump, he has a tendency to shoot from the hip and then rely on being able to sort of talk things back. So that's reason number one. Very quickly, the other two, first of all, the paucity of stuff that actually Russia has to deal for what it wants. And yes, in the short term, Russia would like things like sanctions lifted. But Russia's big picture, Putin's real goal, is exactly a rewriting of the international order. It's hard to see what on earth it can offer to be able to sort of make that deal. And finally, look, we have to realize the limitations of Donald Trump's situation. Ironically, we have a Republican president and a Republican Congress, but in some ways they're not necessarily the same Republicans. This is a president who may well not actually have a honeymoon from his own side, let alone anyone else. He is not an imperial president. He's not even really the CEO of USA Incorporated. It's one thing to tweet out your ambitions. actually, given that the American system is designed in many ways to prevent the president from governing, we'll have to see actually how much he really can in the long term bring forward.
Now, Vladimir, you had a piece in Republic.ru, a really nice piece this week, where you kind of spelled out what the shape of a grand bargain. You were ostensibly responding to the implicit suggestion by Trump that he may trade a nuclear deal for the lifting of sanctions. But you seem to think, if I read your piece correctly, that you think some kind of a grand bargain is possible, no?
Well, I think the feeling in Moscow is that there clearly are deals to be made and to be had with the Trump administration. I think the cloud of uncertainty, a significant cloud of uncertainty, is on what terms those deals will be made and what kind of a proposition the Trump team is going to make to Moscow. And I think it's indicative that the Russian government wants the deals to be made on Russia's terms only. And it's indicative that the Kremlin reacted quite cautiously and even negatively to Trump's to the idea that Trump floated, you know, let's essentially trade sanctions for nukes. I think that's not the kind of structure of the deal that Moscow is looking to. So I think the key question would be, you know, how do you structure the deal? What would be the collateral? What would be the down payment? What kind of interest rates you're going to pay? And what kind of leverage, how highly leveraged would be the deal? I mean, and we don't know that yet. So from Moscow's perspective, the greatest uncertainty is what exactly would Trump ask Moscow to do, apart from, you know, fighting ISIS.
Right. And what can Moscow offer? Because the thing that I keep coming up blank in as I think about this, I know what Moscow wants, but it's hard for me to imagine what Moscow is going to offer here, as you said, other than fighting ISIS. I mean, nuclear arms deals are usually negotiated on their own merit. They're not a bargaining chip for something else. So what I found, as I said earlier in the week on the briefing with Steve Gutterman, I found that proposal kind of odd to begin with. As you noted in your piece, Vladimir, in Moscow, they seem to be irritated that every American president wants to start with this default arms control agreement, which is kind of this throwback to the detente of the 70s.
Right.
What can Moscow offer Washington in this situation?
Well, that's a fairly good question. I think Moscow's problem with Trump and with the new reset is that Moscow wants the new administration to engage on issues of interest to Russia, you know, like the New World Order, as Mark mentioned, and the sphere of privileged interests. And that's precisely why Moscow is reacting coolly to this proposal to start with the nukes, because that's what happened under Obama.
And Bush.
Where the potential for the relationship was exhausted on issues that were of utmost interest to Washington, but of secondary interest to Moscow. Mm. And so they don't really want to step into the same mess again. The question is what Moscow is going to propose and how to engage. And here I think they would take a very cautionary approach at first, and they would try to see they would try to tread carefully and not to provoke Trump, and would take a measure whether they really need to fear the pushback from the Trump administration if Moscow asserts its interests too aggressively. The beauty of dealing with the Obama administration is that Moscow knew in advance that there would be no forceful pushback and that Moscow needn't fear retaliation, whereas Washington always feared the escalation, and Moscow had the escalation dominance and could dial up and dial down the pressure.
Right.
And so they're not really sure about whether they would have the escalation dominance with the Trump administration.
I want to stick with you for 1 minute more before I go to Don. This gets to something I've actually wanted to ask you, Vladimir, because I've been on the surface. It looks like Moscow's rubbing its hands in glee, or at least the Kremlin is rubbing its hands in glee. But I've been reading a lot of stuff that really there's a lot of apprehension in Moscow as well. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, it's a mix. It's clearly a glee because Moscow used the Trump administration as significantly weakened politically by the campaign and the scandals surrounding the campaign. It's one of the most unpopular presidents coming into the job. It also sees it as one of the most incompetent and unprepared administrations, in history. And so if Steve Bannon is going to run U.S. foreign policy, you know, who could ask for more from Moscow's perspective? So,
but is there apprehension there too?
Yes, there's clearly the glee that, you know, the Trump administration is going to quickly drive down the U.S. interests into the ground. The apprehension is that it would turn out to be even more unilateralist than the George W. Bush administration.
That's a high bar.
It's a high bar, but I think that it might be crossed. Mm. And the apprehension is whether the uncertainty and chaos that the Trump administration is going to create in the world is going to create opportunities for Russia to assert its interests, or is going to mess up Russia's interests. Mm. And we're, you know, we don't really know at this point, and Moscow doesn't know that.
Now, Don, how's this looking from Washington, really? Because, like, we're seeing influential senators like John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, they're all on the record as being opposed to a new reset or a new detente with Russia. The U.S. intelligence community is also deeply suspicious of Moscow, to say the least. The Senate is investigating Russian efforts to influence the election. And according to media reports, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies are looking into possible Russian finance and cash flows to the Trump campaign, if I could believe what I read in the U.S. media this week. The U.S. president has traditionally had a pretty free hand in foreign affairs. That's the one area where the president has a lot of power. But given all this stuff that's out there now, are Trump's hands going to be tied?
Good question. Let me answer that and also make a couple of comments on my two friends' observations a second ago. On your question, I think it's important to realize the extent to which Trump is a minority view in the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and not only from the Democrats, but in Congress, as you said, but also, I think, as you saw from the hearings, very much in his own cabinet. And so he's unformed and inexperienced in some ways, and I think he may criticize NATO, but that does not mean 6 months or a year from now he won't be strongly endorsing NATO with some changes. We just don't know that. And I think it's the unpredictability, as well as Mark's accurate comment about two alpha males involved, that is really, I think, really makes it a very, very unclear what's going to happen. And I like Vladimir's comments about the Russian reaction, because you do see this small podobdolka of concern about Trump's unpredictability. And I think in many ways, as somebody wrote, Hillary would have been better, because at least the Kremlin would have known what it's dealing with. On the nuke deal, I think my question would be why would Moscow trade off what is in many ways its major claim to superpower status for dubious other parts of an arrangement? I think that the Trump administration does want a deal, but I think it won't work, and I think a lot of people here think it won't work. And I would be wary, and I'm referring to Vladimir's great article the other day, of so-called U.S. architects trying to finalize a deal. Because one of the lessons of the recent past has been that you can't do all of this top-down. I mean, after all, globalization's reaction is grassroots upward. And I think Trump, and certainly the Kremlin, typically does not take into account enough this kind of popular social movements, which after all haven't hit Moscow yet, but perhaps in the future. Mm-hmm.
Don, one other thing I wanted to ask you as well is, like, the one we know what Putin wants from the U.S. I mean, first and foremost is the lifting of sanctions. That's just a starting point. It wants to go much farther than that, but that's the necessary starting point. How much pushback do you truly expect when push comes to shove, finally, when this has to be decided in Washington, from the Congress, from the intelligence community, do you see much pushback, or can he just do this?
I see a lot of pushback. I've done a lot of briefings this week, in fact, with some private customers about that. There will be pushback. Trump essentially has the winning card, which is that, for example, if in relation to the McCain bill, if they pass something, he can pretty much neutralize it automatically or direct the Treasury Department to ease the sanctions without even the input from Congress. But there's a big gray area there. I think we ought to look at how the sanctions were handled with Obama as a possibly instructive example. And second, there are the many ways in which Congress can tie the hands of the president. And I refer you to the way the struggle between Obama and the Congress over the Magnitsky bill, if you recall, how that worked. I suspect it's going to go in that direction.
Uh-huh. Because my understanding is Congress can codify these sanctions, and McCain and Graham have said they said they have enough votes to get this passed, say they're planning to try to do that. But even when Congress codifies sanctions, there is always this national security exemption, which allows the president to ignore it.
Exactly. And there is that national security waiver, which I expect would be used here. But Trump can also tell the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control, you know, get ready and we're going to do this. And there's really not much the Congress can do to stop him telling the Treasury to work on this. This happened during the discussion of the Iran sanctions modification a couple of years ago. And the Treasury worked pretty quickly once Obama said, do this, to unravel the sanctions. So it's going to take some time. But I think that's the dynamic you're going to see at play here.
Mark, I saw you were writing, which always is a sign that you're thinking, which means you're about to say something really intelligent.
Well, as ever, no pressure. I think, again, what we're really coming at from different directions is this point that up to now, the relationship has been based on political rhetoric. It's easy to talk in generalities about, you know, Putin saying, you know, no one believed in Trump except we did. Not that they did. And likewise, it's easy for Trump to say, wouldn't it be great if we could reach a deal with the Russians? Well, sure, it would be lovely if everyone got together. The point is, these things always founder on the detail. And not just founder, but actually often founder in a slow, painful and exhausting way. And I think this is the point that we're actually getting to, is actually as, and I think this is probably going to in many ways be a metaphor for the Trump presidency, is actually as rhetoric begins to try to be sort of fed into the political process, that's when people say, well, what does this actually mean? How do you expect to accomplish it? Who's going to benefit? I mean, just take for example, that whole nuclear issue. And I'd agree absolutely with what's been said about the sort of exasperation with why is it the Americans always want to talk nukes, and the fact that, you know, obviously from Russia's point of view, this is one of its strong points. But it's also because what it actually points to is the additional participant in the conversation who just happens not to be in the room, which is China. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're looking at sort of what does Trump want? I mean, it is clear that the very time he has been so assiduously stroking Russia's back, he has also been talking very tough about China. And this is exactly something that Putin neither wants nor can afford. He does not want to find himself in a position in which he's having to be asked to choose which team he's on. Because obviously, from their point of view, they need China, and he does not want to alienate America. And that's in part one of the reasons why actually the whole nuclear deal is no longer sort of something that they're interested in talking about. Because actually, if you look at how the general staff is looking at its long-term trajectory, yes, of course, you need a certain minimal level of deterrence towards the West. But actually, the nuclear arsenal is increasingly the trump card to be played against China, a country that is, after all, economically dynamic and arming at a phenomenally sort of quick rate, large population, and it's in Asia where Russia is very, very thinly stretched. So kind of, for all these reasons, the point about the nuclear issue is actually that it's just one of many which becomes incredibly complex as soon as you realize just how many other variables are at work. And that, I think, is going to get in the way.
No, I mean, on the nukes, too. I mean, if you remember during the negotiations during New START, the Obama administration wanted deep, deep, deep cuts. There was even things in the press leaked about minimal deterrence, basically, that really brought it down to the lowest level possible, which Moscow was fiercely resisting for the obvious reason. This is their trump card. They at that time, certainly, were conventionally vastly inferior to the U.S. But you raise an interesting point with China, and I would add to that Iran, because the other country the Trump's talk tough on is Iran. Now, these are two Russian allies. And again, Vladimir, how about that? I mean, how does when you're looking at this from Moscow, you're not just, of course, looking at the bilateral relations. There's a whole constellation here. How does this play? Do you see any kind of pitfalls in the future as Trump gets tough with China, tough with Iran, but wants to make nice with Moscow? Isn't there a contradiction there?
Well, it's certainly not a very good situation for Moscow, although initially, for the short term, Moscow would be flattered to be in a position where It again serves as an intermediary, some kind of a leverage between the United States, China, and the United States and Iran. But longer term, I don't think Trump will get much traction from Putin on pressuring China and even pressuring Iran. Even though on Syria, I think Moscow would unite efforts with the United States other than and sideline Iran. And we see that happening with the Astana talks, where Iran wanted to veto U.S. participation, mm-hmm. and Moscow overruled Iran and invited the Trump team. So I think much less traction on China, some traction he might get on Iran, unless, of course, he unravels the nuclear deal and then all bets are off.
By all bets are off, you mean if he unravels the nuclear deal, it could harm a potential detente?
Well, Iranians would build nuclear weapons, and I think the Trump administration and Netanyahu would have to bomb them, and then we're not in a very good situation.
Mm-hmm. Don, your thoughts about this?
Well, I would agree with my two partners here, but can I say a word about Ukraine, Brian?
Yeah, definitely, because we haven't said the word Ukraine yet.
Yeah, that's the elephant in the room. Yeah.
Let's talk about Ukraine.
guys, you know, I find all this talk about a deal on Ukraine bordering on ridiculous. I think everybody, the three of us, have all written about the Minsk agreements, but even if you had a certain set of agreements, for example, neutralization over NATO's, instead of eventual NATO accession, things like that, I find it extremely difficult that the West would agree to on Crimea. I find it, and this is a minority view, I find it almost impossible that you could pull out the separatists without leaving a lot of damage that no one would want to pay for. And that a lot of these armed outlaw bands are just simply not going to go quietly. You could do it, and they would do it, but it would be very messy. And finally, I find the Ukraine deal, most importantly, hard to believe if most Ukrainians don't go along with it. So I find this, to some extent, the even more than the nuclear stuff, sort of the poster child for unrealistic, realist grand bargaining. I just don't think it's going to work. And I think you're much more likely to see a frozen conflict.
Yeah, no, my problem is exactly on your last point on the prospects of a Ukraine deal. The thing that's always driven me crazy is it acts as if the Ukrainians themselves have absolutely no agency in this discussion. And this is not 1938 where you can do a Munich. This is 1945 where you can do a Yalta. The Ukrainians have very strong ideas about their own future. And even if the government accepted it, a significant critical mass of the society would not.
Remember that the Finland meeting 2 years ago where they forgot to invite Ukraine?
Yeah.
That exemplifies the problem.
Yeah.
Brian, may I jump
yes,
in?
Yes, definitely,
quickly?
Please.
I think one of the things that we need to pay attention to would be Tillerson's testimony at the confirmation hearing, where he actually floated the idea of a bargain over Crimea and Ukraine. And that's basically something that people like Tom Graham were talking about in their interview to the VOA. If the Russians and the Ukrainians agree to that, there is little the West can do about it. If there is a deal between Russia and Ukraine, that would, one, ensure that Russia completely withdraws from Donbass and transferring the border to Ukraine. And Ukraine recognizes Russia's sovereignty over Crimea after, let's say, a new referendum. And also Russia pledges significant compensation that would help restore the damaged infrastructure in Donbass. So if the Ukrainian government agrees to that, what's there for the West to object to?
If the Ukrainian government agrees, but
my question
is, what would happen to a Ukrainian government that agreed to something like that? Because I think they might have a new Maidan on their hands.
That's a question to the Ukrainian government, and perhaps to certain Western governments who have some sway with the Ukrainian government.
No, but my point would be that even if Ukraine's government agreed to that, they would face something of a revolt in their society potentially, and that's for that reason I don't expect them to.
Pay attention to what Ms. Savchenko has been saying this week about the same issue.
Yeah,
I think that's not accidental.
Interesting. Mark, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, if Ukraine and Russia reach an agreement, then there is nothing that the West should do. I mean, ultimately, that's the whole essence of sovereignty.
Right. Exactly.
But on the other hand, I mean, again, I think I absolutely agree with Don that this is one of these areas where it's all very well to make sort of broad sweeping statements, but actually to imagine that this actually could come to pass is very hard to believe. Really, I think that this is, the issue is not so much about bad deals being struck. I think the issue is more about when you have an administration in DC that seems to be much, much less interested in a lot of these places, is actually, well, what will be the outcome of a policy of malign neglect?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that actually DC will come out and sort of broker some grand deal that'll change things in Ukraine. It's more that if it becomes obvious that the United States doesn't care, firstly, how will that actually impact on the European
yes.
position? And what will happen in Ukraine if it becomes increasingly clear that basically no one cares? Yes, of course, it might well be that the Ukrainians will find the sort of inner fire which will hold them together, but it will also make them more inclined, or at least certain elements more inclined, to say, look, we've got to reach some kind of a deal or just accept the status quo.
Mm. I mean, I think it's highly significant that I just read before coming in the studio that President Obama's last phone call to a foreign leader was with Angela Merkel, and I can almost feel a passing of the torch there. He said, "Madam Chancellor, it's all yours."
Because,
you almost felt it. Before we move to the second half, Don, I wanted to touch on one thing we haven't touched on, and that is that the statements of Trump, most of Trump's national security team during their confirmation hearings, have been significantly at odds with the statements of the president-elect, Tillerson, yes. Mattis, and others.
Yes, yes.
What does that portend?
Ultimately, in some sense, only in some sense, the boss prevails. But again, the boss, I think, is still formable in some ways.
Uh-huh.
I think I would highly recommend Josh Rogan's article yesterday, which is the state of play in the war for influence in the national security establishment, where essentially you have Mattis against Flynn, Tillerson probably being the third and least effective of that group, but real decisions are made in that immediate Trump entourage,
Javanka,
and including Bannon. And so I think this is going to be, as they always say, a struggle for influence. But the correlation of forces at the moment is clearly against. If you just look at the advisors. Against a rapprochement with Russia. There's no doubt about that. And I think a lot of people in Washington, especially with the Tillerson confirmation hearings, were reassured that relatively tough line would continue. And
Brent,
I definitely was going to go to you because I wanted to get your reaction to that. That's interesting.
Well, yes, I think 2 points. One is that Moscow views the Trump team as very disruptive to the U.S. foreign policy process, particularly General Flynn. And that's the cause for hope in Moscow. And the second thing that, you know, Moscow has been alerted and spooked by Tillerson's statements and Mattis's statements that indicated a high penchant for unilateralism. You know, Tillerson essentially hinted at the possibility of arming Ukraine. And Mattis basically said, I want U.S. troops in the Baltics on a permanent basis. That's not the kind of talk that Moscow wants to hear.
Mm. Now, if this side wins out, as Don suggested, they seem to have the upper hand at the moment, how would that play in Moscow? We just go back to the default position of confrontation again?
Well, I think no. I think the default position would be to step back and probably let the Trump administration do the God's work of bringing down the U.S. power.
Uh-huh.
And I think the consensus position is that the Trump administration is going to be very disruptive to the U.S. strategic position, and that loss in the U.S. strategic position. And there'll be lots of spaces, security spaces, vacated by the United States. You know, you have Dmitry Trenin today basically saying Trump is U.S. Boris Yeltsin, and we have to brace ourselves for the collapse of the U.S. International order that the Trump team would bring about. And from Moscow's perspective, that's good news. So I think the debate in Moscow right now is whether to continue being assertive in asserting Russia's interests at the expense of the United States, or to take, you know, to take a step back and just enjoy and relax, right. And enjoy it.
So you seem to be saying Moscow wins no matter what in this
yes,
situation.
I think so. Yeah, yes. Because this is an incompetent administration, they'll mess things up, and that will, you know, benefits Moscow.
Don?
Just to, I like to agree with both of these gentlemen when they make excellent points, which they often do. I go back to Vladimir's article in October, I think in the Moscow Times, where he said the hacking incident really has ran the danger of provoking a tougher U.S. response to Moscow. And I do think that's another dynamic you're seeing here. The media.
All right, but, you know, I wrote this with the view with the Clinton administration.
Expecting a Clinton administration.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
No, but I think I read the article about 8 times. I know Vladimir, but it's also true that it has provoked a tougher mood against Moscow and Washington, no matter what Trump says.
In the foreign policy community in Washington.
Yes,
yeah.
There's no question about that.
I wanted to, before we move on, just one quick question to Vladimir about domestic politics. Let's assume a reset works. Let's assume we have a detente. Let's assume everybody holds hands and decides to get along. What replaces America in Russian domestic politics as the big international boogeyman? Because it's been such a staple for so long. I mean, it's. I just don't see what they replace it with.
Well, they'll replace it, with a war on liberalism. And I think if you notice, there has been already a switch to the war on the Democrats and liberal internationalism.
Yes.
from anti-Americanism per se. It's not the United States that is a threat and an enemy. It's the U.S. liberals.
The Democratic Party. Right. Yeah, no,
And I think we're going to have a mind meld here with the Trump administration. We're going to have an ideological alliance of sorts. So, you know, the war will be waged together with Bannon against the liberal international order.
So it's the conservative international we've all been talking
about. The conservative international, yes. There's a potential, to hijack the Trump administration in this endeavor.
Well, on that happy note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and broaden the aperture to look at the fate of the beleaguered post-Cold War international order in the age of Trump. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, a former Russian foreign ministry official, a columnist for Republik.ru, and president of the Left Group. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nisi School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Надежной архитектуры безопасности Европы невозможно.
Требуется архитектура безопасности.
Россия в современной архитектуре международной безопасности.
Вся архитектура международной безопасности просто торпедируется.
So for decades, the Kremlin's been persistently complaining about the post-Cold War liberal international order. And for decades, the Kremlin has been skillfully and patiently pecking away at the post-Cold War liberal international order. And today, the Kremlin has never appeared so close to upending the post-Cold War international order. In an excellent piece on the War on the Rocks blog this week about Russian strategy, the military analyst Michael Kaufman memorably wrote that, quote, 19th century geopolitics is back and it is angry. Vladimir, as I noted in the first half of the program, you wrote this week that Russia is moving beyond Helsinki and toward Yalta. So is the post-Cold War order dead? Is it on life support, or are rumors of its death greatly exaggerated?
Well, I think the view here is that it's definitely is on life support and that the Trump team will turn off the ventilation machine, not the Russian team. I think Moscow feels that it's succeeding in pushing back against the US-led international order and the The idea is to replace the order based on rules with the order based on deals, which Moscow knows how to do. And I think that's what the Trump administration is likely to provide. The key issues would be the security architecture in Europe, the future of the security architecture in Europe, and to a certain extent, the security in Asia, and how U.S. obligations will be either confirmed or significantly reduced security obligations. I think Moscow is seeing that the United States is vacating the leadership positions that it has been occupying for 50 or 60 years. And the debate is how right now is whether we should be more assertive to fill those voids, or we should probably take a step back and consolidate the gains that we have already achieved and let the Trump administration complete the work that that we wanted them to do anyway.
Now, this is the thinking in Moscow, Vladimir. As a foreign policy analyst and an experienced foreign policy practitioner, do you think that thinking is correct? Do you think this is really what's going to happen?
I think that will depend on the first opening moves by the Trump administration, particularly with regard to the Europeans. Mm-hmm. I mean, so far the sounds that they're making are not particularly encouraging for the Europeans. They want to change if not to renegotiate the North Atlantic Treaty, but to change the objectives that NATO needs to pursue.
Yeah, no, the feeling is they want NATO to focus on terrorism.
Yes, refocus from the Russian threat on terrorism. Whether they would be successful in this, it's anybody's guess. But that's exactly the direction that Moscow wants NATO to take.
And if you listen to the president-elect, that's exactly where it's going. But if you listen to his appointees, that's exactly where it's not going.
The architecture and the European security architecture and the transformation of NATO that Moscow wants would be to rephrase the well-known formula. What Moscow wants would be NATO or the security architecture in Europe that keeps the Russians in, the Germans down, and the Americans out. Flip this.
Which would mean the Americans out, the Russians
to Western Hemisphere, yes.
Mark, you seem to be...
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously this is a period in which the liberal sovereignty values-based international order is indeed under pressure. And it's interesting because if one looks at what's happening in terms of the new, or as new presidency looks like it's evolving, deinstitutionalized, depending on personal favorites, depending on the factional ideological struggles for the monarchs here. I mean, one could almost talk about the Putinization of American politics, which is in itself, again, a 19th century approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've long since felt exactly that Putin would be very comfortable operating in the 1800s. Now, in that context, though, first of all, Russia cannot fill the voids that America may be leaving. I mean, we wait and see what America will do, but we should not feel that Russia has lots and lots of spare capacity, that it's just sitting there thinking, gosh, what can we do? Russia can be a spoiler. Russia can, has certainly demonstrated that it can act in some very, very specific individual theatres. But put aside intelligence and firepower, and it actually has very little else to offer. It doesn't have moral authority, and it certainly doesn't have cash. So, I mean, I think we should sort of realise that there are very stark limitations to that. Absolutely, I feel that in some ways... and again, it goes back to some of the issues we were talking about in the first half. I think that Russia's prescription is exactly just sit back and hopefully Trump will do all the demolition work that we needed to. And in some ways, it's a parallel to the changing thinking that the Russians have had over Ukraine. And I remember speaking to people who've said, look, we should never have gone into the Donbass. We should just let the Ukrainians mess things up for themselves. Well, likewise, I think they realize that. And this is one of the reasons why I think they're also refocusing their mischief, their intelligence activities and so forth on Europe and on Europe's coming elections. Because not only are they, and here I'd agree definitely with Don, regardless of the outcome of the presidential elections, aware that you have a national security establishment in America that has been put on alert by Russian activities. But also there's that question of not wanting to push too far and potentially actually create exactly the sort of the result they don't want, which is a Trump who comes to think that Putin isn't his best bud after all. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, put all this lot together, and yes, this is clearly a period of crisis, but the notion that Russia can rewrite the rules of the international architecture and make it into something that it isn't at the moment, I think that is questionable. I think all it's doing is in some ways surfing the wave. China clearly has long since been working on this basis, and maybe Trump will too. And in that respect, Russia thinks it gets what it wants. But the last point I'd make is, actually, Russia ought to be really quite careful mm-hmm. about wanting to bring things to a full red in tooth and claw might makes right geopolitics era. Because actually, Russia is not that strong. Russia's strength has always been precisely that it has stepped outside the same rules that bind everyone else. A world in which no one is bound by those rules, that's actually much less positive for Putin.
It's a potentially very dangerous world for Russia.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Don?
I would say that the world order we've been talking about is hospitalized, but I'm not at all prepared to say that it's terminal. On Vladimir's comment about going beyond rules, I do think we're going into a new form of system. But for me, the question is, do we go beyond values for a lot of people in the West to something else and chaos or whatever you might call it? And I don't see, despite all the problems now, that we are at that threshold yet. Mm-hmm. And we could be, and I very much take Mark's comments about Russia's being weak. And, you know, maybe Russia, all it can do is cause chaos and not go much further. Certainly, I think the China factor is important to look at, because in many ways, China has a strong stake in the current international order, which will be a break on replacing it or pushing it towards some other kind of
Yeah, no, my feeling about China is, as much as they complain about the internet, the U.S. hegemony and the liberal international order, they've always been very, very happy to free ride on it for now, because they're a confident rising power. And they believe, either correctly or incorrectly, they believe their day will come. But for the time being, and if you study history, they are correct. Basically, it's the best thing to do at this point is to free ride on somebody else's hegemony, just like the United States free rode on British hegemony for so long. And thank you very much for that. But Vladimir, what about that? That if Putin gets the world he wants, maybe he should be careful about what he wishes for here.
Well, that's exactly the dilemma that is preoccupying people in Moscow. You know, definitely. It's good from Russia's perspective that the United States should be limited by a certain set of international rules that everybody else observes. It's in Russia's interest that the U.S. military unilateralism is somehow constrained. But on the other hand, Russia doesn't want the same rules to apply to Russia. Mm-hmm. Because one of the advantages of Russia's foreign policy that has been discovered in the past 2 years is that it can pivot instantaneously from friend to foe and from one position to another. And the ability to break rules and to go beyond those rules, as Mark said, is exactly Russia's foreign policy asset. So it's really torn between the need to have a system of rules, international rules, that constrain the U.S., but do not apply to Russia, or just, you know, do away with it altogether and pursue, you know, free for all.
Now, do you agree with Mark that in that free for all world, Russia would be in a very tough spot if everybody was playing by these no rules?
Yes, but I can see those in Moscow who would say, well, what the hell? Everybody's, you know, it's a jungle out there. No, we only have, you know, the military and the Navy and the Air Force.
I mean, I recall a comment made by another former Russian foreign ministry official. It was on Chatham House rules, so I won't reveal the person's name. But he said one of his greatest fears is that America cedes hegemony before somebody else is strong enough to take up hegemony. Because, as you know, basically hegemonic orders are more stable than non-hegemonic orders. I think this is something that history teaches us. Don, you wanted to say something.
Yes, yeah, just on this clever but I think not terribly deep comment about 19th century geopolitics. I mean, people say that, and I think if you push it, it really is sort of silly. I think the forces that are undermining the global order, as I said earlier, are from the ground up, not Metternich and other people saying this game's on the table. And that is disrupting the system, but it's coming from a different direction. So I don't think we should be pushing the 19th century image too far, because that leads you into another set of miscalculations. The other point...
Go ahead.
Okay. We have Kurganov's piece this week, in which he says basically the objective should be the Congress of Vienna. Yes, that's where we should be heading, but for a while we can do with Yalta.
Well, this is what I've been long saying, that Putin wants to party like it's 1815. Don, you wanted to finish your point.
The other point is more Middle East related, and I think there is a potential here for what do the Obama call it, snapback, that the U.S. will pull back, and given Trump's apparent personality profile, he may then abruptly reverse and re-inject the U.S. into a lot of places, especially if there's some disillusionment in the relationship coming by. What got me thinking about this was the interesting raid by the B-2 bombers on Libya two nights ago, which to me was a parting Ash Carter message to Russia, in part, that we are still there and we can refuel our bombers in midair, and things are still, with the U.S. is not quite pushed out of the Middle East yet. So I took that as partly a message to Moscow, admittedly by an outgoing member of the Obama administration. But I think we should not take a U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East or elsewhere really as set in stone. I don't think it necessarily is, especially with Trump.
And I would also add that these deployments that began this week to Europe, these things are kind of hard to reverse. They tend to take on a momentum of their own. And I think Obama accelerated those deployments for a reason. I think that reason is pretty obvious. And we're all four smart guys. We know what that reason is. Mark, one of the things you said, one of the silver linings that we might see in all this, is that it might cause Europe to get its act together. It might cause Europe to get its act together. And again, going back, I did find it highly significant that President Obama's last conversation with the foreign leaders was with Angela Merkel. And I was only saying half in jest that he probably said, it's all yours, Madam Chancellor, because I think that's kind of what's happening right now. A lot rides on Germany right now, and a lot rides on Europe. How important do you see Europe rising to the occasion? And how important are the series of elections we're going to see in Europe? If Merkel holds on in Germany, if we don't get Le Pen in France, can Europe basically rise to the occasion and hold this architecture together, even with a disinterested and disengaged America?
Well, when you say holding the architecture together, I mean, in some ways, I'm not convinced that is the crucial thing. I mean, it's not necessarily about a specific architecture. Because, again, it's not as though we are in 1970. Mm-hmm. It's not as though actually there are these huge red legions just on over the border that, given the opportunity, could happily roll eastwards, Rand notwithstanding. So, I mean, I think we have to realize that there's a different kind of threat. And when we talk about Europe, there's the European Union, which has been making certain sort of advances under Federica Mogherini in terms of sort of building some kind of more meaningful foreign and security policy. But nonetheless, maybe it's just the British side of me that finds it hard to truly expect to find a prompt salvation in the European Union. I think we've got at least 10 years worth of subcommittees. But Europe is not necessarily the same as the European Union. And I think this is actually what's going to be interesting. Is first of all, yes, seeing how individual countries that we think of as the sort of the crucial ones, Germany and France, and Britain as well, which is, I mean, it may be heading for a hard Brexit, but it isn't going to be towed away from the continent quite yet. And it still remains the single most important provider of military power in Europe. Obviously, if Angela Merkel holds, if we see a different election result in France, that's all.
And we're seeing some encouraging signs in the,
yeah,
in
absolutely.
The last...
But also, I mean, I think we should think about in terms of what are other countries doing? I mean, are other countries getting more serious about defense spending? And the answer is slowly, grudgingly, yes.
Germany just announced it's increasing its defense spending by 2 billion euros.
Sure, but in some ways, Germany needs to sort of build up its forces after, again, hollowing them out quite ruinously. But I think other countries as well, countries which up to now have been sort of relatively easy to, again, use your phrase from before, free ride on whether it's NATO or the European Union or the Brits or the Germans or whoever. But actually sort of other countries spending more money, other countries also getting more serious about other forms of security, whether it's in terms of counterintelligence, intelligence sharing, dealing with the flow of money, or even the kind of bugbear of the moment, disinformation campaigns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think in some ways the European countries are getting scared. How far the European Union will be able to express that effectively remains to be seen. It's an open question. But the individual countries themselves are building up. And I think that is significant, because Russia's great strength has always been, not that it's a really strong one, I say always, post-Soviet, not that it's always that much stronger than everyone else, but that it's stronger enough than each country individually. It can't take on any of the alliances. That's why, for example, it regards NATO as basically a very, very serious obstacle to any kind of military adventures. But it is also aware that it can lean on, through a variety of ways, individual countries. So by them getting more serious, and perhaps by building greater solidarity between countries, there is a possibility. I can't make it more than that. I'd love to be able to say it's definitely happening, but I don't think it's something that we can rule out.
Now, I know you're skeptical of the idea of a European defense force because it undermines NATO. What about if we have a NATO that is fracturing due to American disinterest and disengagement?
Well, I mean, even within the European Union, there are mutual defense obligations. So, I mean, in some ways, if absolutely it had to be, I mean, not much is made of that at the moment, precisely because no one wants to set the European Union up as some kind of rival to NATO. But, I mean, even within the EU, there is the framework there. And certainly if NATO looked like it was splintering. But we've got to bear in mind, though, is that I cannot, and obviously sort of, I'm hoping that Don is not going to turn around and tell me how wrong I am. I cannot see even Trump saying anything like, well, we're going to pull out of NATO, or we're going to sort of, in other words, deeply change it. It might well just simply be that America is less interested in NATO.
Right, but America being less interested in NATO means a weaker NATO.
It means a weaker NATO, but it does not mean a NATO that fragments. I mean, actually, the European powers themselves actually are not inconsiderable. Yes, they are nothing compared to the military might of the United States, but we should not rule it out. If you actually look at the kind of the operational military forces of Russia, they're not that great. Actually, there are all kind of other ways of dealing with it. I do not see the threat being from this kind of Third World War headline-grabbing scenario. The threats actually are precisely of lots of individual countries feeling they have no option but to make shabby little deals, or just simply to say, look, do what you want with Ukraine or Georgia or maybe Belarus in the future. You know, that's one.
And then
that's
sooner
different.
Or later, Poland, Slovakia.
No. I don't see it going that way.
You don't.
That's
see it
the thing.
Down.
I mean, I think we should not assume that this is some kind of global creep. I think Russia has a sense that it both deserves and needs a sphere of influence, and that these countries that I've mentioned are part of that rightful sphere of influence. Again, terribly 19th century. I'm sorry, Don, but I think that still works. But I don't think it's that they actually have some kind of global hegemonic ideal. I don't. Even Putin is not that grandiose in his aspirations.
I don't think a global, but I definitely think European. But I'm always Mr. Worst Case Scenario here. Don, how much is riding on the Europeans? And if feel free to tell Mark.
Actually, I agree with much of what Mark said. My comment about the 19th century was the difference between intentions and reality. My prognosis for the EU and all this would be much more gloomy than for NATO. And I think that the Trump people, I think down the line, and depending on what happened with Russia, would be satisfied with a commitment or evidence by many members that the spending and all the other issues they've raised is more robust. And I think they would leave it at that. That's my my impression. So I think that the prognosis for some kind of demise of NATO, I think, are much, much exaggerated. But I do agree with Mark that the bilateral and multilateral relationships within Europe are becoming much more important. Even the Balts, RAND report notwithstanding, are making moves, and I work with them a lot. So I do think Mark is largely correct. Russia, of course, has tried to forge bilateral relationships with a lot of these European countries. But again, a bilateral relationship in a formal sense is different than the kind of undermining of the societies that the West is seeing that they're practicing, and Moscow is practicing. And as I mentioned earlier, it's worked to a significant extent in terms of inflicting damage, but the awareness of it compared to 6 months ago is much, much higher. And you see a very much more robust European pushback on information war and other things, much more than in the United States.
Yeah, no. So, and this is all, of course, predicated on the fact that Chancellor Merkel holds on, that Le Pen doesn't win in France. This is all predicated on a lot of ifs that are coming up in the coming year. We're bumping up against the end, Vladimir, and so I'm going to give the last word to you.
I think the problem for Moscow with a new European order would be there'll be too many unruly cats to herd from Moscow's perspective. And obviously the Ukrainians would be the hardest cats to herd. So even if there is some implicit recognition on the part of the Trump administration of Russia's privileged interests, it would be really hard to, you know, to enforce those interests if the host nations would really object to be, you know, to be the subjects of the application of those interests. And so I think it'll be down the line, it'll be a calculation whether it would be worthwhile spending the resources on, you know, projecting those interests against the will of the population. I mean, Belarus is a pretty good example. I think there is a significant pushback from Lukashenko to Moscow against the attempts to put Belarus under at least military control of Moscow and economic control.
Yes.
So they'll be pushed back, and I think the resources that Moscow can bring to bear are not limitless.
Right. No, I think Belarus is a very illustrative example. In fact, Putin's done the impossible. He's unified Lukashenko with the Belarusian opposition, which is something I never thought I would see. Okay, on that note, we shall wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, a former Russian foreign ministry official, a columnist for Republic.ru, and president of the Left Group. And joining us from Washington, D.C. has been veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFURL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.